to live a decent life in very horrible poverty conditions that were created because of deindustrialization, that were created because of racial discrimination, all these things. So yeah, you know, the media portrayal of what's happening in terms of the poverty in this country, and we have to give a lot of credit of these horrible interpretations to people like Daniel Monahan. You know, the Monahan,
oh, yes.
You know, the infamous Monahan report,
yeah.
that pushed this culture of poverty garbage, social pathology. Also, we got to talk about, you know, the William Julius Wilsons of the world, the ones who pushed non-racial policies in American society to deal with poverty issues. And then also argue that people that African Americans are uneducated because they choose to be and all this other ridiculousness. So yeah, that's what I'm saying. And the reason I'm bringing all this up, listeners, is that the president is so far removed from the conditions of the working people and the experiences that he has the nerve to say that he feels underappreciated for his work in getting us into an economic recovery that doesn't exist.
You know, it's amazing. You know, we were talking earlier with Christina about the university administrators. I mean, I think it's similar with Obama. I think they're just out of touch with reality.
Yeah.
In general.
And what's interesting, yeah, exactly, because they don't come from that particular experience. They don't talk to those people. Mm-hmm. They don't have relationships with
them.
And
they sure don't walk in their shoes and live in their conditions.
And here's something that's also interesting that people need to start taking note too, because poverty has been homogenized as being an urban issue.
I was just going to bring that point up, Gus. Those figures, any specifics on where these areas? I bet there's a lot of rural areas in addition to urban.
But let's talk about statements that people have never thought about in terms of poverty. Poverty has also risen significantly over the last 15 years in suburban areas.
Yes.
So yeah, this is something that a lot of people aren't considering and looking at the changing of space in this country. So what they have right now is that more than 1 million people outside of urban areas now living in neighborhoods are of concentrated poverty, and workers of every race and ethnicity have been affected, and also immigrants and native born people. Mm-hmm. So what you have actually is that for the first time, poverty. There are poverty-stricken suburban areas that are starting to expand. Now, of course, you always had that whenever you've had suburban areas in history, but they were very few of them until recently following the stuff that happened in the 21st century. So now you're starting to see expansions of suburban poverty. So you have urban and suburban poverty, and of course, rural poverty has always existed. So this is something that the media and the federal government is not addressing, is that poverty is expanding. I mean, so that this is something that we have to start considering. Mm-hmm. So when the recession does hit, and it is coming, if you've been paying attention to a lot of the economic indicators, this is going to be a devastating recession that may be worse than the 2008 one. And I mean, it's getting ugly.
Yeah, you drive through a lot of these small towns, you know, and it's like you go through the business sections, you know, 2-3 blocks or whatever, and it's unbelievable. There's some, you know, exceptions, but for the most part, it's like half or more of the storefronts are closed up or crumbling, you know, and what happens is, you know, these a lot of young people move away because there's no jobs, there's, you know, everything, and most of them end up in the military because there's no other opportunities, you know, here we go, the vicious cycle, empire, globalization.
And that's another thanking Monahan for that mess that he put in his report. The Monahan Report, if you haven't read it, people, you really should, because it's really one of the earliest arguments of social pathology and what it did for militarization, you know, in terms of arguing that African Americans males need to go into the military to deal with the
poverty. Okay, issues. I wasn't aware of that. Okay.
Yeah, that was one of the major arguments of the report, is that that militarization of African American males will help the problems in the U.S., So yeah, and that's what, yeah, like you say, they turn to the military because there's really no other work available. And that's the thing that we have to
And college isn't affordable, so.
No, college is definitely not. Yeah. College is never going to be affordable again under this current system. There is no turning back with capital. That's one thing we have to recognize, is that capital, while it doesn't move linearly, it moves in spaces, but it doesn't ever regress, so that you're not going to see college be affordable under this current system, unless the system itself is redesigned.
Yes.
I mean, they have their eyes on the prize, the ruling class at this point. Mm-hmm. They've seen
more.
Yeah, they've seen how much money education makes in the U.S.
One of the last frontiers of untapped money. Yeah, you know, they're going after the public education sector because there's, I don't know, I saw a figure. I mean, when people like Bill Gates jump into something, you know that there's not just, there's tens if not hundreds of billions of dollars right for the picking to these vulture capitalists. And of course, you know, after that, they're going to go after Social Security. Mm-hmm. You know, I mean, they look at these, any kind of monies that are there, that's not being used, that's, you know, cycled through the, you know, it's not being privatized, it's not being cycled through the stock market, mm-hmm. and, you know, whatever, they consider it, being, just basically, worthless, if you will. Kind of like what, you know, European, you know, colonialists used to think when they'd go and conquer lands from Ireland, you know, Africa or Native, or North America, mm-hmm. to where, basically, or the enclosure laws, you know, in Britain, yeah. You know, yep. I mean, this is how far back it goes. I mean, it's, you're right, Gus, it's a mindset. It's a screwed up mindset, that's just pushing us to the brink here, but not just economically, but, you know, our global environment as well.
Yeah. It's not, if we start only thinking of it as economic, we're in trouble. But the problem is that people don't want to address the economic the way it should, because if you address the economic, you have to address capital. Mm-hmm. And people do not want to reimagine a world without capital, because that's all they know. Mm-hmm. You know, this is something that we have to seriously address, but the best thing about it is that it's not very doom and gloom though, because people are awakening.
Yes.
I mean, there are movies coming out of Hollywood now every week about, that are critiques of capital. You have working class organizations. You have student groups now, like what happened with Chicago State. They're actually making statements about how capital is destroying their schools and their communities. So these are arguments that weren't being made 20 years ago.
Yeah.
So you do have you have a beginnings of a critique of capital, but we haven't gotten to that point yet of actually making the argument of abolishing it.
Yes.
So like I said, this is a long process, listeners. This is not something that's going to happen immediately within the next 2 or 3 years.
Mm-hmm.
But you're starting to see the bubbling of people critiquing the problems of capital, to getting to the point to where people are going to start thinking of how to abolish it. So I'm very optimistic in human agency in that. And that's why we can't rely on the pessimists and the, you know, the old school people who really just think that the capital is just so oppressive that it just takes away your humanity. It takes away your ability to have social relationships and develop. Then that means they don't know how capital actually operates, because it's actually create the conditions for people to organize and start making these critiques and understanding their conditions. So it's a powerful thing that we see happening. And NTFC strike is a very good example of that.
Indeed. Okay, we're going to take a quick music break, and we'll be right back. We're going to extend the program into the 12 o'clock hour here. You're listening to the World Labor Hour on the Supported Community Radio Station, WFT in Champaign, Illinois, 90.1 FM, and live worldwide at WFT.org. And we'll be right back. Stay tuned. Okay. Alright, well, I'm gonna lose this. Man, I twisted my knees.
One for all. One for all. It's all for one. Let's start a union. Call it every human. It's one for all and all for one. Let's live in unison. Call it every citizen. It's one for all and all for one. We don't want war.
Can't take no more. It's drastic time for sure. We need an antidote and a cure. Cause do you really think Muhammad got a problem with Jehovah? We don't want war. Imagine if every prophet was alive. And current days amongst you and I. You think they would view life like you and I do? Or would they sit and contemplate on why do we live this way? Act and behave this way. We still living primitive today. Cause a piece of the destination in war can't be the way. There's no way. So people just be a woman, be a man. Realize that you can't change the world by changing yourself, and understand that we all just the same. So when I count to three, let's change.
Time for grand philosophy. I barely keep my head above my thighs. I got this mortgage, got 3 kids in school. What you're saying is the truth, but really troubles me inside. change my mind. If I could live beyond my fears, exchanging unity for all my insecurity, exchanging laughter for my tears.
One for all, one for all. It's all for one.
Let's start a union, calling every human. It's one for all and all for one.
Real tough position in the midst of all these negative conditions, divided by beliefs, differences in religion. Why do we keep missing the point on our mission? Why are we killing each other? What's the reason? God made us all equal in his vision. I wish that I could make music as a religion, then we could harmonize together in this mission. Listen, I know it's really hard to make changes, but two of us can help and rearrange this, cause utilize our power and our voices. Together we will unite and make the right choice and fight for education, save the next generation, come together as one. I don't understand why it's never been done, so let's change on a count of one.
It takes one, just one, and then one falls the other one, and then the other falls another one. Next thing you know, you got a billion people doing some wonderful things, people doing some powerful things. Let's change and do some powerful things. Unity could be a wonderful thing.
Okay, we're back. That was the Black Eyed Peas doing a song called Union, and I want to dedicate that to the non-tenured faculty union. And, you know, I was really surprised when that song came out by Black Eyed Peas, because I never really considered them a very, you know, political or whatever. Some good lyrics. I mean, you know, it starts with one, and then next thing you know, you have a million, you know, kind of thing. And it's a good organizing, you know, theme song. But anyway, we want to shift gears here now to honor May Day, which is 130th anniversary of the Haymarket incident in Chicago, which is May Day being tomorrow on Sunday, is celebrated around the world as International Workers Day everywhere except for the most part the United States, even though people in the United States make great efforts to celebrate it. Anyway, Gus, I'll let you take it from here as far as you know, why should people be interested in May Day?
I mean, let's be honest. If we really go back through history of the United States, most of the transformations of this country have been determined by the position of labor. I mean, we're talking about slavery, the most, you know, the commercial, or in other words, commercial capitalism was the dominant mode of production for hundreds of years in this country. I mean, let's not forget, at the height of the empire of the U.S. at that point, cotton, the 95% of the world's cotton came from the U.S. slaves. You know, so this is
95% of the world's supply. Wow.
By 1860s. Yeah.
Wow.
Yeah. And then also too, when you look at the sugar, you know, most of it coming from the Caribbean islands, from slaves in the Caribbean islands. So like I said, there's a labor component that's central to how America has transformed over time. You go into industrial capital and industrialization and the building of cities, you know, and the populating of cities. You go into what's happening now with neoliberal capital. You know, at the center of this, while we talk about these transformations, the only way these transformations work is how the workers respond to said transformations. These things didn't happen organically. These things weren't something that just were created out of the air for these capitalists, but workers made them happen because of their agency and their movement. And the reason why May Day is so important is because it centralizes the workers and what their conditions force them to do, and standing up for the rights of not just themselves, but all workers. Because we're talking about sacrifices. We're talking about massacres of people who stood up and said, we are not going to take this exploitation anymore. So that's why, you know, May Day is something that we have to recognize as being it's something that's not given to us like these other holidays that are just given to the U.S. by the U.S. ruling class. Mm-hmm. But May Day is something that workers have created for ourselves to celebrate for ourselves. Mm-hmm. You know, and I think that's what that's the best part. To be honest with you, I'm kind of happy that the U.S. doesn't have a national May Day celebration, because it would be co-opted into some garbage.
Yes.
You know, I love
look at the Martin Luther King.
Don't even get me started.
Yeah, yeah.
On that. Ooh. But yeah, but see, I love to see when, like what David did this past, yesterday and creating a May Day rally and celebration on the campus and force people who never even heard of May Day to stop by and listen and get some knowledge and actually enjoy the rally itself. You know, that's because we, you know, we're organizing this. We're doing this as workers and not the ruling class mm-hmm. and the national groups and stuff. It's a powerful demonstration of agency that people really need to start embracing. And mm-hmm. So that's what I'm saying. I really think that May Day is probably one of the most powerful holidays that workers have, and we must celebrate it and we must talk about it. And yeah, I got tons of stuff on the Haymarket Massacre if we want to go into that.
You know, one thing I wanted to say real quick, I mean, I'm 58 years old. So when I was growing up, you know, during the 60s as a kid, I mean, it was during the height of the Cold War, and May Day to me, I had no idea what it was except for that's when, in the Soviet Union, they would have the big military parades.
Yep.
And you'd be surprised the number of people, you know, in their 40s and older, that's what they think, that it was basically a Russian holiday created, by the, a communist government there.
Yep.
And that was also celebrated in communist China and wherever else.
Yep.
And they don't realize that this is actually started in Chicago, Illinois.
Right in Chicago. That's right. Let's be honest though, we're talking about this as if it's something that, you know, people just are ignorant about, meaning they don't have knowledge, but there's been a concerted effort to shift and to counter any celebration of May Day.
Sure.
You know, I mean, people don't want to recognize that what happened at the Haymarket Massacre and what happened in other labor disputes surrounding May Day were powerful depictions of how capital feels about workers and why it's such an ideological struggle.
Mm-hmm.
And I mean, you know, they don't want that type of understanding to come about, because once people understand that, you're going to see more disputes and more demonstrations, because they know what can happen if we challenge our oppressed state. So yeah, so you want to go into the massacre itself and get into it?
Yeah,
so,
sure.
Let's talk about this, y'all, because I think this is one of the most important parts, and I'll give it this: while labor is not a very well analyzed part of U.S. history in terms of the historiography, a lot of it is either conservative or liberal. You know, the Haymarket Massacre is something that is well documented. So there are tons of books that you can get on it, and most of them are very good books, because most of them are published by people who are former laborers themselves
mm-hmm.
and also scholars of labor history. So, but let's talk about it. So in 1884, the U.S. Federation of Organized Trade and Labor Unions had passed a law declaring that as of May 1st, 1886, an 8-hour workday would be the full and legal workday for all U.S. workers. The ruling class had that much time to recognize this law and to put it into effect. But here's what happened. The employers refused. On May 1st, 1886, workers took to the streets in a general strike throughout the entire country to force the ruling class to recognize the 8-hour workday. So you had over 350,000 workers across the country directly participated in this general strike, with hundreds of thousands of workers joining the marches as best they could. So you had the initial 350,000, then you had the ranks swelling,
mm-hmm.
and it kept swelling to the entire country was just overflowing with people supporting this general strike. And again, we've seen what happens in general strikes. The last major general strike was the slaves general strike during the Civil War, you know, that ended slavery and just crippled the South. So you know there had to be some type of response. So in what they would later be called, even though I hate this term, riot, they called them the Haymarket Riots. And for those listening, riot depoliticizes political events. That's why it's better to be called uprisings, rebellions, or pogroms, because that puts a political definition behind the actual actions. And the ruling class and the petty bourgeoisie love to use the term riot because they don't want to assign anything political to major disputes about race, labor, class, gender, sexual, anything that has to do with discrimination in this country. So in what would later be called the Haymarket Uprisings, during the continuing strike action on May 3rd in Chicago, the heart of the U.S. labor movement, the Chicago police opened fire on the unarmed striking workers at the McCormick Reaper Works, killing six workers and wounding untold numbers. An uproar across the nation resounded against the government and this police brutality and murder, with workers' protest rallies and demonstrations throughout the nation set to assemble on the following day. On May 4th, Chicago members of the Anarchist International Working People's Association organized a rally of several thousand workers at Haymarket Square to protest the continuing police brutality against striking workers on the South Side of Chicago. As the last speaker finished his remarks that rainy evening, with only 200 of the most dedicated workers remaining at the rally, 180 armed police marched forward and demanded the workers to disperse. Then, deep within the police ranks, a bomb exploded, killing 7 cops. The police opened fire on the unarmed workers. The number of workers wounded and killed by the cops is still unknown to this day. 8 anarchists were arrested on charges of, quote, inciting riot, end quote, and murder. The retaliation of the government was enormous in the days to follow, filling every newspaper with accusations, completely drowning out the government murders and brutality of days past. So this is something that we can definitely connect to today. Mm-hmm. Whereas in nobody talked about Freddie Gray when the rebellion started in Baltimore. All that you kept seeing was that they're uncivilized, they're rioters, they're violent, they're destroying their own stuff, you know. So there was this criminalization of the people to get away from the brutality and the repression by the government and police forces. This is something that is historical, people listening. This is not something that is just contemporary. So this was a way that they dealt with this back then as well. So 8 workers were convicted as anarchists. Eight anarchist workers were convicted of murder and were convicted of inciting a riot. Only one of the 8 men accused was present at the protest, and he was attempting to address the crowd when the bomb went off. In one of the greatest show trials in the history of working class movement, no evidence was ever produced to uphold the accusations, though all 8 were convicted as guilty. 4 of the prisoners, Albert Parsons, August Spies, George Engel, and Adolf Fischer, were executed. Louis Lean committed suicide, and 3 remaining were pardoned due to immense working class upheaval in 1893. On May 1st, 1890, in accordance with the decision of the Paris Congress of July 1889 of the Second International to commemorate the Haymarket Martyrs, because that's what they were and that's what they're always going to be known as amongst any working class circle, as martyrs, mass demonstrations and strikes were held throughout America and Europe. The workers put forward the demands for an 8-hour workday, better health conditions, and further demands set forth by the International Association of Workers. The red flag was created as the symbol that would always remind us of the blood that the working class had bled and continues to bleed under the oppressive reign of capital and what happened in Haymarket. So from that day forward, and going through a bunch of different countries, from going into Russia, into China, into India, so going out of America into all these different areas, workers throughout the world began to celebrate the 1st of May as a day of international working class solidarity, fighting for the right of freedom to celebrate their past and build their future without the oppression and exploitation of capital. So again, like Dave said earlier, there's a misconception about May Day. May Day originally started in Chicago when those workers stood up for the rights that they deserve and were brutally repressed by the American government, which again to this day is not been, you know, the books that have come out have done a great job of that. But you never hear the federal government making apologies about it or acknowledging it.
Yeah.
You know, like, so it's really interesting. What they do is they try to demonize the anarchists because of their political ideology, mm-hmm. instead of recognizing that they murdered tons of people in these days of the Haymarket Massacre and then also the executions. So again, you know, we need to recognize that the only reason why this is such an important part of American history is because it is working class. It's because the working class, during slavery, just like during any type of militancy and labor organizing during the industrial revolutions in America, just like any point where we can even take it to South Africa with the consciousness movements and the Durban strikes. I mean, whenever people recognize a powerful change for the lives of people and recognizing their rights. It comes from worker organizing, working class solidarity. Mm-hmm. And that's the only way we're going to ever deal with the problems we're facing today is solidarity.
Yes, indeed. You know, one book that I'm almost finished with about Haymarket called Death in the Haymarket by James Green, really well documented. I mean, he has maps of the city of Chicago at that time showing where the major places, industries were, like the lumber yards and the McCormick Reaper plant and other things. And they show on these maps, too, where there were labor disputes. And, I mean, the dots are all over the city of Chicago. Yeah. This is in a 20-year period. The book pretty much starts at the death of Lincoln, Lincoln's funeral coming through Chicago from Washington, D.C., and on the way to Springfield, Illinois, to be buried. And it was a very kind of positive time. Like we were talking before the show, Gus, about how this was also a positive time in the South, you know, on the liberated South, if you will, Reconstruction. There was this hopeful period of where, you know, slavery had been, you know, abolished. There was all sorts of African-American communities being formed, Freedom Towns, I think they were called, And then in the North, you had, you know, of course, all these promises of new legal legislation. In fact, there was Illinois was passed a 8-hour workday law in 1867, but when it's supposed to go into effect, the major capitalists just ignored it and said, "Screw you, we're not doing it." Likewise, you know, with this you're talking about, and so I guess what I'm getting on this book, what it shows was that there was like a 20-year period of labor strife, struggle, violent repression going on, building up to this Haymarket incident.
Yeah, you could honestly say that. If you go back to around 1860 to Haymarket, that's a good number of years. It's about 2.5, a little early decades of labor strife that led to that particular moment. Yeah, because you had workers standing up, and just like I mentioned at the beginning of the show, the longshoremen were one of the major groups that really were prevalent in pushing for a lot of better working conditions. And not surprisingly, a lot of people don't know this, but African-American women were also withholding their labor on sharecropping farms and for better conditions as well. So they will hold these general strikes as well as getting together and saying, we're not going to work anymore until we get better pay, until we have better facilities. I mean, it was in different industries and different groups of people that were exercising their rights as workers. So yeah, this is something so what I'm trying to say, listeners, is that as much as capital is central to the transformation of America, worker resistance and worker struggle is just as central. That we recognize history in America, workers' struggle has to be central to any conversation about how America has transformed. I don't say develop because for obvious reasons, but transform, because worker struggle is right at the heart of it. It works in dialectics, you know? So yeah.
Yeah, it's interesting too, because the mayor of Chicago at this time, guy named Harrison Carter, I believe his name is, he was considered quite the progressive, you know. But it was interesting because he had little control over a lot of things, even though he's the mayor of the city. It was the big capitalists that had, you know, a lot of the control. In fact, he didn't even have control over who the police commissioner was.
Yep.
And I guess this guy Bonnefeld, who was the police commissioner that led this attack, you know, and everything. He replaced a guy previous to him that was considered too soft on the workers. You know, because what this previous guy did was basically just had his police stay out of labor disputes. Oh my, that's you know, what a concept, you know.
Yeah.
But nevertheless, you know, this guy Carter, this mayor, he actually was there at Haymarket and left just shortly before the police moved in. Mm-hmm. And before he left, he went to the police station nearby and said, "It's a peaceful gathering. No need to mobilize your men."
Mm-hmm.
But this Bonnefield went ahead and did it anyway, you know. And this mayor even testified on behalf of the defendants in the Haymarket trial, which is another interesting thing about this book. Talk about a sham trial from the beginning to finish.
Yeah.
Do you know, during jury selection, all the jurors, I'd say 98% of the jurors, and there was probably about 300 potential jurors, all were either small business owners, clerks, foremans, or superintendents who work for some of the major companies in Chicago. You see where I'm going with, you know, or they were like, say, attorneys themselves or, doctors, you know, sort of the bourgeois middle class kind of people. No, they were only like was about probably half a dozen working people actually brought in. Mm-hmm. And the, and some of these people that were, in the jury pool were actually related to Chicago police officers.
Oh yeah.
And basically, if you're familiar with how the legal system works, the defense can only disqualify so many people, mm-hmm. And likewise the prosecution can. So this tactic was flooded with all these people and have them use up the allotted number they can excuse, and we're still gonna have a jury that's gonna be, you know, sympathetic to, the exactly. prosecution. So that's what they did in the very beginning. And then, it went from there. I mean, up to the point to where the press was extremely biased, urging the jurors to do their duty and convicting, you know, and finding them guilty and sentencing them to death. And even at the end of the trial, when they were found guilty, except for one, Nibe, who got 15 years in prison, the Chicago Tribune, I think it was the time, and I think some of the other newspapers in the city basically congratulated the jurors and said that prominent businessmen in the Chicago community were going to be raising money to give to them for their services. I mean, basically coming right out there and saying that they're going to bribe them. Yep. You know, I mean, unbelievable. And of course, during the trial, I mean, almost every single defense motion was overruled, every single prosecution, you know, objection or statement upheld, and I mean. This reminded me of the book I read when I was about 14, 15 about the Chicago 8 trial, in which I read the actual whole transcripts. And I mean, it was just a sham trial. Yep. You know, it also reminds me of Ashanti Shakur's trial, too, that she had her multiple trials, you know. I mean, this is some part of the history, the repression. It was just, you know, also usually ends up in being a sham trials, you know. And, you know, besides the actual brutality that the police inflict out on the streets, you know.
Yeah, you know, this, what's really interesting about that is that, you know, that would be probably the best movie I would love to see, because I think we talked about this before, that there hasn't been a really good labor movie recently that shows the actual power of the workers in the movies. You know, they're usually movies where the workers are destroyed at the end, or
yeah.
they take away their agency in the movie itself.
Or there's one strong man, like, say, yeah. the film Hoffa with, exactly. you know, Jack Nicholson.
Yeah, I would love to see the movie about that trial, because, you know, and that's one thing that I found interesting. I don't know if you got to watch the OJ show that came on FX, but they broke down exactly how easy it is to corrupt the judicial system to your favor. And that's what the OJ lawyers did. They said to themselves, like, we could care less if he's guilty or not. We're going to exploit the system that we know so well to make him not guilty, mm-hmm. regardless. And so what you just said is exactly what they've done throughout history, is that they take the number of jurors that they're allowed to, and they manipulate who they invite in. And they use so many different ways. So I would love to see a movie about that made and show just how easy it is to manipulate a broken judicial system. Because yeah. that's what people do.
Okay, we're now joined by Tariq Khan. Tariq, welcome to the World Labor Hour.
Hi, how you doing?
Good. So, we about, 10 minutes, 15 minutes ago, we just started talking about Haymarket. And so, I was just talking about this book, Death in the Haymarket by James Green. Mm-hmm. And one of the things that I thought was commented on was about how there was a 20-year struggle, all sorts of labor struggles up to 1886, so it wasn't just something that's happened out of the blue, and also about what a sham the trial itself was. I mean, you know, basically from the get-go in the jury selection, you know, even. So I guess that's where we're kind of at this moment. So any point you want to jump in about your thoughts on our basic theme is, why is it important for people to know about and celebrate May Day?
Right, absolutely. I'm so glad you guys are talking about Haymarket, because that's kind of a forgotten part of U.S. history and really a part of international labor history. And it's very interesting, because it's actually, you'll find that Haymarket is remembered outside of the United States more than it is yep. here even.
Yeah.
Now, when we've had international, you know, Latin American labor organizers and people will come to the United States and they'll say, you know, I want to go visit Haymarket Square. And people, their handlers will be like, what is that?
Well, until a few years ago, all there was a small brass plaque on a sidewalk back in an alley. There wasn't that wagon, the sculpture you have today in the little monument.
Right. And the monuments actually are, I mean, that's fascinating in itself. Historical monuments are kind of, can tell us a lot they become sites of contestations over public memory. And so there's definitely a struggle over the memory of Haymarket, who's supposed to be remembered as the heroes of the police or the labor movement. And so, you know, at Haymarket Square, there was a police statue there for the longest time.
Oh, yes.
Yeah. And the you know, working class people around there resented that. There was this police with his finger pointed, and they were constantly vandalizing it. At one point, a streetcar driver somehow managed to make the streetcar jump the track and knock over the monuments. And, you know, back in the 70s, I think it was the Weather Underground, or blew it up. And I think they put another one there, and they blew it up again. And it was just constantly being vandalized. At one point, they had to put a police detail around it. And these police just had a 24-hour guard for this police statue. And the police themselves were kind of annoyed. Like, I didn't want to become a cop so I can guard a statue. And at one point, they actually had a bunch of the statues. It was being vandalized so often that they just had a bunch of them made so that they could just replace it.
Yeah.
And eventually, they just realized this isn't worth it. And I think it's in a police academy somewhere.
Yeah, I heard in a courtyard in the center of the police academy. So that it's inside even. It's not even outside.
For the longest time, there was nothing there to commemorate, you know, what happened. And then so, you know, there would be all kinds of sort of street graffiti actions that would happen there to remember Haymarket. And then eventually they put the statue that's there now with the wagon it's a little bit abstract so that it can be anything to anyone, so the police can look at it and think it's honoring them. The labor movement can look at it and think it's honoring the labor movement. Although really the labor movement has claimed that space. I mean, I was out there and it was just covered in pins from labor unions from all over the world. There was a Turkish labor union pin there, an Iraqi labor union, an Iranian labor union. There was a Spanish labor union. There was just unions from all over the world where people had come and they put their pins on there. Mm-hmm. And so even though it was meant to sort of be anything to anyone, really the labor movement has claimed that space and made it about labor.
Exactly.
Yeah, because that was also what Gus and I were kind of talking about too, is the, you know, the efforts to try to, you know, suppress the whole history of May Day, the Haymarket thing in particular, you know, how it was, you know, for the longest time, you know, they called it Law Day, I think it was.
Right.
You know,
Law
on
Day,
the calendar.
Loyalty Day.
Loyalty Day, that's right. That's
the
other one.
They tried to erase May Day and they started having Loyalty Day parades. You know, actually they made it against the law. So like in Cleveland, for example, the union folks would come out carrying, you know, red flags for socialism, you know, remembering the real spirit of May Day. This is a radical socialist holiday. This isn't just a, you know, oh, thanks workers, we really appreciate your hard work. But no, this is a day for workers to come out and make demands for systemic change. And so they would come out and they'd carry the red flags, and the business owners started sending out vigilantes and were just beating people up, taking their flags. And then Cleveland actually passed a law making it illegal to carry the red flag. And eventually they started having Loyalty Day parades where you come out with the U.S. flag and these patriotic displays of, you know, anti-communism. And this was made specifically to erase that history of the labor movement.
Yeah.
Ronald Reagan made it Law Day.
Okay, that's who did it.
Yeah, and Obama has continued that tradition as well. I forget what Obama made it, but he also made it some kind of, you know, day that has nothing to do with labor.
Exactly.
And so that's why it's so important, you know, the state and the capitalists, they understand this history and they know that it's in their interest to erase this holiday.
Yep.
You know, those of us in the working class movement, we've got to reclaim this day and really make it, you know, not just sort of this sanitized hooray for labor, but to really reclaim this as a radical working class day to make demands on the system.
Now, you were at the May Day event we had at the University of Illinois Quad yesterday, but have you been at other May Day events in larger cities during the course of your lifetime?
Sure. So the largest ones I've been to are in Washington, D.C., where really it's largely the immigrant movement that reclaimed May Day. You know, it was largely immigrants that are, you know, immigrant laborers who made May Day in the first place.
Yeah, German.
And so.
Laborers, immigrants, yes.
And so then
now
in the early 2000s, it was largely, Latino immigrants, who immigration reform movements and things like that. And they connect that very correctly to the labor struggle. Mm-hmm. And, they were the ones. So there would be, I mean, there was one that was tens of thousands of people. May Day celebration, and folks were carrying, you know, their Mexican flags and their you know, what from what are the various countries that they were from, they were carrying those flags, and I remember Fox News was throwing a fit. Oh, they hate America. They're not even carrying the American flag, blah, blah, blah. And, you know, I'm just saying good for them, exactly. Right? You carry the flag that you want to carry. This is May Day. This isn't Loyalty Day or Patriotic Day. This is a day for the working class to come out and show their power. And so, yeah, there was every year when I was in D.C., there was huge, huge marches, largely led by immigrant organizers.
Mm-hmm. Yeah, it's amazing that I was talking to somebody quite a few years back, and he was saying that he was in a rural village in Mexico, in southern Mexico, it was like around May 1st, and there was like a little, I don't think, celebration going on. He asked what it was about, and he answered in Spanish for the Chicago martyrs.
That's right.
You know, I mean, here this is known even in remote areas of the world, in, you know, rural areas, you know, the significance of what May Day is and where it started in Chicago, Illinois.
Yeah, I mean, I have family from Lahore, Pakistan, and you go into the Awami Workers Party office there in Lahore, and you'll see hanging on the wall the pictures of the Chicago anarchists.
Interesting.
I mean, this is a history that internationally people know this history, and yet here in the United States it's almost like only like people in the radical movement know, and it's not really taught that much in sort of the public school system or in the wider society. It's kind of largely forgotten. And so it's kind of interesting. You go to Pakistan and they know who the Haymarket Martyrs are. And you go to Chicago, where the Haymarket Martyrs were from, where they lived and organized, and people never heard of them.
Mm-hmm. Yeah, well, I mean, that sort of repressive erasing of history and framing of narratives is effective. That's why they do it. Anyway, as far as May Day, how it's celebrated in other parts of the world, you see, like in Europe, a lot of times. In fact, I knew a German woman who said, "Oh yeah, May Day used to be fun. We used to go out and get drunk and then go get in battles with the police." It was a tradition. Nobody really, everyone knew what their roles were, and it was almost, even though they did get rowdy and stuff, it's interesting though that I think the labor movement, at least what I've seen in the last 10-15 years, is starting to, if not grudgingly by their leadership, starting to accept May Day as a, they're starting to talk about it again, because, man, I know 20-30 years ago, they didn't even want to talk about it because there was all this stigma from the Cold War. I was telling Gus, when I grew up in the 60s and I was a kid, I didn't know what May Day, I thought May Day was a Russian holiday to celebrate their pulling out their, tanks and everything else, and that's what I think most Americans 40 years and older were brought up to believe,
Even in the early 20th century, the mainstream sort of bourgeois union leadership did not like this day. Samuel Gompers of the AFL, the IWW used to call it the AF of hell, because they had this very middle class, they just only wanted to organize skilled white male labor, male workers. And so there was a lot of a little bit of tension between kind of the rank and file folks and the leadership. But Samuel Gompers hated that the Haymarket anarchists were heroes of the labor movement, and he went to Europe and he was touring the different labor halls, and he said, "What a shame it is that they, the unions in Europe are full of these anarchist ideas." Terence Powderly of the Knights of Labor, he did not like that anarchists had taken over the locals, and socialists.
Yeah.
And so you definitely saw a tension between the locals and what the radical vision that they were fighting for, and then the sort of the bourgeois leadership of the unions who wanted this more respectable, we can sit down with the bosses and come out with a fair deal. That's not under this system. That doesn't work, right? And so there was a lot of people at the local levels who understood that, as long as that this is a systemic problem. This isn't a problem, that the boss isn't a nice guy. He could be the nicest guy in the world, but there's a certain logic to how capitalism works, and we've got to organize against the capitalist system.
And that's why you really have to start, we have to start critiquing the union movement deeper than we've been doing. I know Dave and I, and this show in general, we always talk about the issues of the labor movement in this country being founded on a lot of petty bourgeoisie ideals. You don't have this mentality of workerist tradition where the workers determine what the union does. You have that in parts of South Africa and different labor organizations there. And you had a tradition of that to some extent that really helped them, get some change there. Some change.
Mm-hmm.
But here, it's always been, like Tariq said, there's this petty bourgeoisie leadership that has continued to this day to everybody's favorite terrible union leader, Dennis Williams.
Now the UAW, yeah.
Who create austerity for the UAW workers, the rank and file who are being laid off every day as we speak right now because of the deal he signed. This is something that is not contemporary. This is something that is core to the American labor movement. And we have to understand that until we make it to where the workers determine their own stuff, instead of getting these people who were part of something that, you know, you got labor leaders now who never even worked.
Yes.
In that position.
Right? James Hoffa, the Teamsters, yeah. He's an attorney. He never drove a truck.
That's what I'm saying.
Richard Trumka, he worked for the mine workers as their attorney right out of college. He never went down in no mine shaft.
Went down there. And if you don't have the experiences or the relationships with the workers, you will never serve their interests. It's plain and simple.
Yeah.
And again, we can continue to lie to ourselves and say, well, you know, he can still fight for the cause. He knows how to be a lawyer. He knows how to do this and that. No, if you don't understand the experiences, that's what Christina was just saying with NTFC. The people across the table from them literally have no idea how to teach a class, mm-hmm. and why they would ask for certain things that they're asking for in their contract. They actually can't comprehend it. Mentally,
yeah.
Because they don't have the experiences of the workers, and that's what's been driving the American labor movement in this country for too long, and that's why you haven't had a real solid, not only a critique of capital from the masses, but also how to abolish said capital.
Mm-hmm.
So that's why there has to be a more workerist thriving at the center of the American labor movement. There needs to be a transformation of the labor movement if it's going to be a powerful entity in challenging oppression.
Okay.
Amen to that. And you know, you mentioned James Green's book, Death in the Haymarket. You know, great book. But that's one of the things that James Green mentions in that book was that, you know, back in the day when the unions really were a threat to the bosses, a threat to the capitalist class, James Green notes that the union organizers, they were scrappy fighters. They weren't guys with management degrees.
Exactly.
Right? They weren't, you know, guys from, you know, the middle class. They came out of the ranks of the workers and they were fighters.
Yeah.
I really think that, I support all unions today. Even unions that I think have a lot of structural issues. You know, I don't support police unions, but I support all unions, other than police unions that, you know, even if I don't think they're necessarily as democratic as they should be, because
mm-hmm.
I think a bad union is better than no union. But I think that if we really want to strengthen the union movement, we've got to get to those democratic bottom-up roots and get away. You know, I applied for a job as a union organizer back in the day when I was younger and more idealistic, and the guy that it came down to me, I was coming from an activist organizing background, and the other person that I was up against was a guy that had a management degree and, you know, wore a suit and tie and stuff. And that's who they hired, was the guy with the management degree, not the guy with the organizing experience.
Right.
And I think that speaks volumes about what kind of problems we have in the union movement today. And so I criticize the union movement as someone who loves unions, someone who comes from a union family. I got union organizers on both sides of my family in Pakistan and in the United States. I love the union movement. And I want the union movement to get to its radical, democratic, bottom-up roots.
Yeah, and I can speak from experience of being in a very undemocratic union and how it just corrupts and makes things worse for its members, even when they try to make change. And lengths they'll go to, causing economic ruin and hardship for those members who do try to make changes, and also how they're able to buy the best corporate attorneys money can buy with your dues money, and even pay off politicians and judges. I mean, we went through the whole gauntlet of that, of trying to do internal reform. And, it just, the whole system stacked against us. I mean, the whole legal structure stacked against us. We didn't know this going into it, but we learned, you know, coming out of it, is that there is a mentality of almost feudalism in this country of how the law in the United States looks at union members. They look at unions as franchises, and that, you know, as opposed to, Canada, where we did have one carpenters union that, successfully, actually, was a whole province, the province of British Columbia, that just told the International Carpenters Union to go take a hike and pulled out successfully despite three legal challenges in the Canadian courts. Why were they successful? Well, because Canadian labor law, at its basis, has the will of the rank and file members, the majority of the members. And that's the bottom line. We got a feudalistic labor law system in this country, you know, against the members. And I'll tell you what, I'm really passionate about this because I encountered a lot, when this rebellion was going on back in the late 90s, early 2000s, I encountered a lot of people on the liberal left who didn't want to get involved in any way because they were afraid, you know, it's going to hurt unions. And I used to say to them, you know what? Nothing's going to change in this country until we can, you know, change the union movement from within. Yeah, I mean, until we can get rid of these collaborationist, corrupt union leaders that, you know, don't care. I mean, that not only sell out their members, but won't do a darn thing to help progress in this country move forward for everybody. Yeah. You know, that, to me, that's the bottom line.
That is.
Why it has to change.
Yeah, I mean, I think you said it best. I think it has to come from the workers themselves. We have to start thinking of ourselves and understanding our social conditions as being very similar. You know, we have to go across different industries. We got to go across different crafts. We have to go into communities, and we have to understand that our conditions, that we are an oppressed class. You know, class has to be something that we bring back to and being central.
Indeed. That's right. And, you know, we learned too that it's kind of a, we encountered this, we thought that we could get the Department of Labor to come into these sort of things when we were playing around with this in the legal system. Well, we found out that their attitude towards us, they were more afraid of rank and file, overthrow of existing union leadership, kind of like what their attitude of the State Department would be for a real democracy somewhere in the developed world. They'd rather deal in a lesser developed world. They'd rather deal with a dictator they can buy off, you know, than to deal with a real people's democracy. Likewise with the union movement, you know.
I mean, just think about the GEO. Even though it's kind of a, unique situation.
Mm-hmm.
The leaders of the GEO are members.
Yes.
You know, the members are the ones, and then they have democratic elections every year, so nobody can hold positions. None of them make money to do that position, and they've had some of the greatest successes in the state of Illinois in terms of their militancy and getting contracts, you know, getting health care, getting wages and stuff like that, getting all types of things. So you know, I mean, I'm not saying that everything can work just like that,
mm-hmm.
but the fact that the members run and determine what the local does, that speaks volumes to what happens with the labor movement if that is something that becomes mass.
Yeah, and some graduate unions weren't so lucky as a GEO to get like a unique kind of independent charter. I know some graduate employees unions that are organized with the UAW have had some problems recently.
And that's the problem.
Yeah.
I was so happy at the May Day rally yesterday that at least three of the speakers, including Gus, brought up Lucy Parsons.
Oh, yes.
Yeah. That made my heart sing. Because, you know, Lucy Parsons is one of my all-time heroes.
Yeah.
And, you know, she was at the founding convention of the Industrial Workers of the World, and that was her main goal for being there, was she wanted to ensure that this was not going to be a top-down union, that this was going to be organized from the bottom up, and that it was going to be radically democratic from below. And I would, you know, I think we need to, we need to resurrect the spirit of Lucy Parsons in the labor movement today.
You know, the two main inspirations for the speech I wrote was Lenin and Parsons.
Mm-hmm.
You know, because it's particularly Lucy Parsons, because no other person I can think of brought the humanism to radicalism like Lucy Parsons did. When you read her speeches, mm-hmm. and you read the things she said and how she was able to equate the oppression of the body and the mind in terms of labor struggle, nobody has ever done it better.
Mm-hmm.
And so that's what I think is something that Tarek just hit on that's very important to why Lucy Parsons needs to be central to any movement for labor. It needs to be taught in every school. It's because she understood that this is not something that if you address capital and oppression from a personal standpoint, understand what happens to the mind, body, the spirit, the emotion behind it, then you really start connecting with people. And this is something that you just, I'm just backing up what Tarek said in that she's one of the few people that I can just say that I'm just enamored with. And I really want more to be done for her in terms of scholarship, in terms of celebration. it needs to be something that we as workers take upon ourselves to bring it back.
Well, unfortunately, we're just about right out of time, but Gus, before we go, I wanted you to just give a shout out to the listeners about a TV series that you've been watching recently.
Oh, yeah. you know what? And this is the most surprising part about the situation is that WGN is one of those low-key channels that comes out of Chicago. And they recently have been putting out some original programming, and one of the best programs out right now is Underground, which is about the creation of the Underground Railroad, and it focuses on a family of African-American slaves who are getting ready to and making conscious decisions to run away, and how, and what it does is it actually complicates what people think about the railroad and shows all the different parts of it instead of people just thinking that you just go on the run, you go to Canada, and that was it. No, there were so many decisions that were made on the plantations and farms. There were decisions made on where to go, who was going to go, and how to send messages back to get other people or to let them know you were okay. I mean, there's so much involved in that show. It's very complicated. The writing is so superb, and it just got renewed for a second season because it's actually one of the most watched shows so far in 2016.
And how can someone, if they missed the first season, is it playing yet on any other
Netflix soon.
Platforms?
Oh, okay. It's going to be on Netflix soon. I think the first season is about to wrap up. So again, you have a, and that's one thing that we have to recognize about why consciousness is really developing across the country and the world, is that you have people now who have existed in these oppressed states that are starting to go into more middle class areas instead of getting people from the top down to take this stuff, because you have the OJ show that really exposed how race and class is so prominent in oppression in this country. It was a good critique of capital and racism. Then you have Underground. Then you have all these other movies coming out, like Money Monsters coming out, which is exposing the housing crisis. You had The Big Short. You got all these movies out here and media starting to really understand a critique of capital. Soon it's going to turn into not just critique, but abolishing capital.
Well, we can only hope so.
It's a process. It's a long process. But all that comes from the workers, though. All that comes from the workers rising up and taking stands, and people taking notice of the stands we're making because of our positions. So let's always keep that the workers are central.
Okay, right. Tariq, thanks for coming in. Any last words for our listeners before you sign off?
Organize.
Okay. All right, you've been listening to World Labor Hour. Listen to supporting community radio station WFT in Champaign, Illinois, 90.1 FM, and webcast live worldwide at WFT.org. And until next week, be safe and power the people. Take care.